this night is kind of legendary, like I'd heard loads about it, and I'm just delighted to be here. You've got a good reputation around the country. So it's an honour and a privilege. Is that okay? Am I close enough? Can you hear okay?
A bit louder, please.
A bit louder, please. Okay. To come across that a guy I knew some years ago was making them as an experiment in County Clare. He was an American living in Clare. He loved to make instruments. And so it's actually strung with fishing wire. Five or six of them. They're all between Ireland and the UK. So this poem is called What Dream Woman Never Said. Dream Woman Never Said It Would Be So Hard Jump over the edge. Then back again. This is a fantasy I have. To go there and bring back a story in one piece. Thank you. and forth, so Grace is going to read me what I'm going to do. I'll share this space.
So, Siobhan and I read together, maybe.
Thank you. Perfect.
Siobhan and I have read together a couple times now. Which is brilliant. We met swimming on a writer's residency. Both of us went in the lake together. I'm more of a page poet myself, but I think it's lovely to go backwards and forwards a bit between the two. As Siobhan said, like, it's a real pleasure to be here. She was saying you've a great reputation around the country, say even internationally. This gig is just known for being such great crack and having loyal, devoted following, so it's really special to be able to be with you here tonight. My book launched almost a month ago to the day, and it's so exciting to have my first proper reading from it, to be able to share that here with all of you tonight. So, delighted to be here. This first poem, maybe following on from Siobhan's Dream Woman, is about a woman who came to me in a bit of a dream. Mm. I grew up in Greenwich Village in New York City, and my dad ran a bookstore during the beat scene, and I grew up in a little apartment above where the bookstore used to be. But before the building was divided up into apartments, it was one big building that all belonged to this famous Irish-American movie cowgirl, who was one of the only speakeasy owners in New York one of the only female speakeasy owners in New York City during Prohibition. So she was pretty bold. My father told me that she bought for herself a solid gold bathtub, which vanished when she died. And of course, this obsessed me. Like, how could you lose a solid gold bathtub? How could you move a solid gold bathtub? Let alone lose it. So I was sure it had to be somewhere in the building and that I was going to find it. So this first poem is Solid Gold Bathtub. I grew up sure I'd seen the ghost of Texas Guinan in the doorframe of my bedroom one night. She lived here, owned this building from basement to rooftop, before it was divided up into a shop floor, a boiler room, and a rectangle of walled garden. Texas lit out of Waco and became herself, lawless, fearless, savvy with the dollar. The first movie cowgirl, queen of the West, MC of her 300 club up on 54th, where she greeted all the rich boys with her signature, "Hello, sucker." She hid the booze in case of a raid, glimmering bronze and copper in the triangle of light cast by the hideaway door that opened just enough to slip through. No stranger to roundups, a walk to a waiting Black Maria, a breeze through the Jefferson Market jail before the short journey home to 17 West 8th Street, full of her antiques and her gewgaws. Rumor had it she bought herself a solid gold bathtub. My father said it vanished when she died. Or was it stashed too? Hidden first and then forgotten, solid and shimmering under a film of dust. I scraped at every crack, there were many, and dropped pennies through gaps in the floorboards, listening for the sound of metal bouncing off metal. Unsure if I believed in her ghost or believed in the stories. For this next poem, we do a slightly shorter one. Again, kind of going back to my childhood, I went from a New York City government school, which is known as a public school. I think in the UK, they're reversed, like public and private. But I got a scholarship to a private school, and in private school you had to be able to write all of your assignments in cursive. Because I didn't know how to write in cursive, I had to come in early every day, and almost like you see like Bart Simpson in The Simpsons, like, you know, rewriting the same words and same letters over and over again. That was me. So while this kind of practicing cursive writing would seem like punishment or this extra thing you had to do, for me it turned into a meditation on the feeling of kind of falling in love with the practice of one's craft. So for me, you know, being a writer since I was young, just the act of writing, of holding the pen, of moving it across the page is so deeply soothing. And I suppose this practicing cursive was the first moment, oh thanks, when I fell in love with this feeling. So this next poem is called Handwriting. It took all my focus and patience to learn to write in script. Hours of practice, rising early to sit alone in the classroom, tracing a letter again and again. Knowing the room's four walls and the silence, and understanding that I had to catch up. In private school, you do not print. It was this routine of rising early to practice alone, through which I felt each letter's form slope into meaning. I continued this task of tracing the letter below the blackboard with yesterday's lesson, swept into swirls by a wet sponge, the handwriting, the letter repeating across the page. Hand over to Siobhan again.
She was 26. And so normally when I perform this, I've done it many times and shared it with people, but there wouldn't be anyone like who would have known her, but as it turns out, my friend Loretta is here tonight, so I'm going to dedicate it to Loretta, who would also have been a friend. So it's not often that I get a chance to, so this dedicated friendship that goes back a long time. Home for the girl with red hair. This poem is for the girl with red hair. She has naturally red hair, but she dyes it red all the same. Packets of voluminous red, fire red, sunset red. She even dyes it black, so it grows back in tiger stripes, and she wears a hat to hide it on holidays in Rome. This poem is for the girl with red hair. When we hitchhike to Mayo together, people stop and say, "You two must be sisters." And we say, "Soul sisters." She tells tall stories to the drivers who randomly stop on our way to knock. Even if she likes to tell stories, even if she goes for a short walk to the shop, she says, "You'll never guess what happens." She comes back breathless. She makes wild gestures in the air with her hands. This poem is for the girl with red hair. I met her one day in a corridor when I was studying letters and she was studying to be free. We made many journeys together. This poem is for a journey that goes beyond this life and into another. This poem is for the girl with red hair. Every time I speak, she enters silently, then disappears again in a quiet whisper only I can hear. Something like the wings of a condor across the Andes. She wrote me once in a letter. She said, "I stood at the top of the mountain and I watched the condor fly in an arc, in a ribbon, in a trail of wind." She liked to write letters. She wrote long letters. Sometimes they were too long, like an exaggeration. She loved to exaggerate. She wrote for many pages and she numbered the pages and drew diagrams to illustrate her jokes. Her handwriting curled like the curling clouds she described when she sat on the roof to watch the sunset and be a camera. This poem is for that girl who teaches me to laugh, even in the serious moments. She likes to pretend. She plays shop with her cigarettes and wears a colorful collection of hats. She says, forget about all this. Let's go for a walk. She's taken me for many walks. Sometimes I see her face in the city, in the face of many faces. Sometimes I hear her voice in the wind. Some kind of music, some kind of magic. This poem is for the girl with the red hair.
Again, this one's even a short one, so I haven't been up here that long. I'm a really avid meditator, and I made great friends with a guy who used to do a bit of the housekeeping around the meditation center that I go to in Mayo. And he's just a brilliant character. Like, every time you'd come across him, he'd have like a joke or a story or something else for you. But he was a jack of all trades. He seemed like he could do anything. He was always like hanging from the rafters, you know, sorting out new insulation, fixing everything. He was a plumber by trade, but he also did a stint in his life making violins. Mm. The technical name for somebody who makes violins is a luthier. I didn't know that myself. And we just had this beautiful moment once in the center where he talked to me about the kind of tree that you select when you're preparing to make an instrument. Maybe your friend went through this and he has African carps. So this poem is dedicated to him. His name is David Lynch. Sadly, he passed away 2 days after I got the first copy of this book in my hands. I really wanted to give it to him. I was able to give it to his family, but he knew there was a poem coming. He knew it was for him. So this is a short poem. It's Luthier in the Forest for David Lynch. To make a fine instrument, what's needed is a good timber. Come from a tree that struggled to grow. Exposed to extremes, the winter freeze that stunts, forcing each ring in a little tighter. Until one day, a greater solidity forms. To hold and carry vibration, tone, brilliance. Thanks for being here.
Totally crazy.
Yeah. On Amazon.
Didn't realize I was small. Thousands seek every day. crossing borders with just the clothes on their backs, their ears, still craving for the whine of a shell, the chop, chop of helicopter blades. This is what they have died for. Crossing icy mountains by nightfall, or ocean waters in a tiny boat. This security, this godlike quiet with only the day ahead. The hold of a child's hand on a May morning, a thin mist down in the valley, with houses poking through the chimney stack. Orderly slates on a roof. The loose hen pecking the ditch nearby. Sheep bleating all around. This is it.
Sticking with the theme of migrations, obviously I'm not from here originally, and I left New York City when I was about 18 years old. Both my parents passed away by the time I was 18, and when I was 18 years old I left to go to university. I guess I was in a bit of a unique position. I was, you know, saying goodbye to, you know, my friends, like everybody else, but also really seeing my home for the last time, and very unsure of what my future would be, or, you know, kind of figure out a place to go to hang my hat or to ever go back to. And, you know, maybe the U.S. is very different from Ireland, and some of it has very poor social protection nets. So in many ways, it's very easy to slip through the cracks. And in many ways, people, as they probably do here as well, make up for the gaps in what the social welfare system provides. People really take care of each other. I was very lucky to be a part of a community and a school where people really pulled together and really helped us out when we were going through a hard time. And that includes some of my friends, their parents. And this particular poem is about one of my English teachers from elementary school and his wife, who kind of saw me off to university in a way, maybe the way your parents might. They were just very generous with their time, with their encouragement. And they took me for this walk. They made me lunch and took me for a walk in downtown New York City along the Hudson. And we came upon this monument, which if you're ever in New York, it's free to go see it. It's called the Irish Hunger Memorial. Yeah, you know, it's really striking. It looks, from above, it looks like a spaceship. It looks like it's about to take off, but it has like native grasses from Ireland, and it has a stone cottage that's been transported. It's a really interesting piece of art. It's made by an architect and artist called Brian Toll. We had this experience of kind of walking around. It's an interactive monument. You can climb up it, as you well know. Long before I ever had any notion I'd end up living here. But it was this kind of very special moment when I was saying goodbye to my home. So this poem is called The Irish Hunger Memorial, Battery Park. And it's for Rod Keating and Caroline Stone. On the day I'm leaving home, we discover it. Entering through the tunnel of fluorescent backlit clips and scraps of a story too long to tell coherently. Layered over the eerie glow are poems, parliamentary reports,
Letters, recipes, names, statistics, songs, and blank spaces still to be engraved. When we come through it into the day, before us is a tilted half acre on Battery Park. It must have been started before the skyline was transformed. We follow the path passing the cottage from Adimas County, Mayo, that is no replica, was once someone's home, until we're peering out beyond the island's southern tip, over the Hudson with its ghost pier disintegrating, the Statue of Liberty, Ellis Island. Looking out in stillness, I wonder if we're seen by the workadays in the offices above. I'm carrying a book on the essay, his gift to me, and the scarf with sparkling threads that she took off and handed me through the car window. The old cycle of consciousness versus craving is broken momentarily when I realize that I was in need of people to say goodbye to, brought back to the present by the surprise of this memorial to the devastation of hunger. The river before us like a clearing, mimicking time, moving us forward. And this next one is actually from kind of after I'd settled in Ireland. I grew up in New York City, always on public transport, never owned a car, and was always deeply envious of those who had the experience of the like drive-through car wash. So this poem is, I don't know if you know Castle Wellin in County Down, this is a Castle Wellin car wash. I have always wanted this. Sponge forming suds, bits like lace flying, shielded from the soapy ropes and the scouring blasts clouding the laminated glass. Water runs in streams, too thick to be seen through. While we are warm and dry and together here for the long drive home and for now, the spectacle. Thanks for giving back to Siobhan. Thank you.
7 days and nights I spent up there.
Also in the voice of I have a lot of poems that are written from the perspective of men from the Old Testament. We can psychoanalyze that later. But this one is this one's the voice of Noah, of the Ark fame. And this poem is called The Flood. Such sea legs Noah has to keep his eyes open in the shower, for fear of breaking his nose on the tile walls.
He drives himself the proper way, the way his father taught him, and wonders if it is possible that he can be here, naked in another's home. Whose bed is this that does not slide across the floor? Whose windows, not streaked with rain, rise above a green lawn? Nothing creaks. When a robin settles in a tree outside, he leans to hear if its wings whisper, "Land, at last land." He wonders, why can I not breathe in the smell of salt? Whose children are these whose feet pad on solid ground? Am I the only one who remembers? Did I survive the sky's complete letting go? Can home have washed me to another shore? Can one step, just like that, from the heaving, pitching arc? Thank you.
The drummer flex his hands, a set of brown-skinned congas vibrating to his tune. A saxophone picked up the beat, gave it some heat. We were cooking alive in there. The girl with chestnut hair began to sway. I lay back in your sweet embrace, my lips tangy with lime, touching the line where I end and you begin. A cocktail of rhythm and easy breathing.
This is a poem about my, oh yes, grandmother, who I had a bit of a complex relationship with, but the longer I'm alive, the more I appreciate her boldness and what she had to teach me, directly or indirectly. She was just really her own person and went against cultural norms in a lot of ways, twice divorced in the 1950s and 60s, which like hardly anybody did. And it must have been, I mean, I think a lot of the risks she took were real struggles. But this poem is a bit of an ode to her her indomitable spirit. This is called Halter. For 2 years, Dorothy kept everyone out. Visitors, even me. If a hand fell on the bedroom doorknob, she'd tense in another room. Don't go in there. Don't mess up my papers. By the time we discovered what she knew, the roof had fallen in during the last record storm. Pale blue insulation covered everything in drifts. She made up her mind to go, the mind that was already hollowing out. Little sinkholes out of nowhere, pulling its calm surface down to chaos and then nothing. That August, with the election looming and the Virginia heat, she rested and worried while we carted away 22 sacks full, backwards and forwards in what we started calling the Havisham Room.
insulation disintegrated in our hands as we grasped for more. Until the room was like before, except for the exposed chipboard above and the smell of all the seasons that had blown through it. We searched to salvage, fingered her colorful silk, still folded, though water-stained and ruined by mold. We untangled costume jewelry. She bought herself a piece with every paycheck. Opening the drawer that held her lingerie sets, protectively wrapped in brittle tissue, beside a copy of the Kama Sutra, her helpful friends from church hurried out, and I was left to empty the drawer alone. At 65, Dorothy, my grandmother, retired and by then twice divorced, cut and sewed herself a yellow calico halter top, modeled on a Vogue pattern. No sleeves, but a strap around the neck. She'd slip it on to haul out her portable Remington to type the reverend's notes, details of Sunday service, requests for auction donations, and updates from the book group and the Pie of the Month Club. One of her church friends told me how Dorothy once wore the halter to deliver the newsletter. How the reverend looked her up and down before beginning his rounds to each desk in the church office, stopping to ask if Dorothy would ever learn to dress her age. He stared at the scalloped folds of her underarm before scanning the newsletter for typos and sending her back to type it again. I hold the book in the room we've come so close to restoring and try to imagine her at the bookstore buying the Kama Sutra. Did she wear the yellow calico halter? Walking to the counter, did she look the cashier in the eye? I think maybe she did look at him and smile. Thank you all so much.
Girls, thanks so much for coming all the way down from Dublin to read for us tonight. Really enjoyed it. And as I mentioned earlier, Grace has got a chapbook for sale and Siobhan's got a CD for sale. So during the next break, if you're interested, feel free to come up. So let's give it up once more for Grace.